Listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 226 votes.
On January 6th, Vice President Kamala Harris certified her own loss to Donald Trump in the 2024 presidential election. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning ProPublica reporter Josh Kaplan. He covered the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, and as a major new expose headlined The Militia and the Mole.
I think anyone, even the most powerful people in the Republican Party, foresaw that Trump would be able to come back from this right after the Capitol riot. And just like he came back, there's been something else happening in the shadows. Militias that seemed at death's door right after the Capitol riot have been able to resurge.
Then acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha on his New Yorker piece, Requiem for a Refugee Camp, which focuses on Gaza's largest refugee camp, now in ruins, Jabalia. It's where his grandparents grew up. And as former President Jimmy Carter's funeral services begin today, we'll feature a clip of my interview about his new book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Americans don't want to know. And many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land.
And we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin about Carter's legacy in Latin America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is warning its efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip are at a breaking point after Israeli forces opened fire on a World Food Program convoy over the weekend. Staffers documented at least 16 bullet holes in their aid convoy's three vehicles, saying the shooting left them terrified. Earlier today, an aid worker with Central Gaza's Man Distribution Center died from injuries sustained from an attack on the flour distribution site Sunday. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry reports another day of Israeli attacks has killed at least 31 Palestinians, injuring 57 others. Among the dead is the neonatologist Dr. Tabat Salim, killed in an Israeli strike on a house in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Just hours before her killing, the 30-year-old Dr. Salim had finished a volunteer shift providing care to women and children at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. Meanwhile, Physicians for Human Rights Israel reports Israel's military is refusing to reveal the location of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the jail director of Gaza's Khamel Adwan Hospital, and won't let his lawyers see him. This is Palestinian nurse Mohammed Al-Namnam, who was arrested alongside Dr. Safia when Israeli forces stormed the hospital December 27th.
We were treated violently and subjected to beatings. They don't distinguish. There's no mercy or any kind of humanity towards medical staff. The Israeli troops forced us to remove our clothes and they hit us with weapons and sticks.
We'll have more on Gaza later in the broadcast when we speak with the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Monday he's stepping down as leader of Canada's Liberal Party after mounting speculation and internal dissent.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
Justin Trudeau has been Canada's prime minister since 2015, but faced plummeting popular support as well as opposition within his own party, with his finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigning last month amidst a public spat over how to respond to Trump's vow to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods. Freeland is considered one of the possible successors to Trudeau, as his close ally, Dominique LeBlanc, who was appointed to replace Freeland in December. Liberal Party economic advisor Mark Carney and Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, are considered top contenders as well. Canada's scheduled to hold federal elections this year. Polls indicate Canada's Conservatives would win elections if they were held today. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who's been compared to Donald Trump, has pushed anti-labor and anti-regulation measures and called for expanding oil and gas development. On Monday, Trump responded to Trudeau's announcement by posting on his social media site, "If Canada merged with the U.S., there would be no tariffs, taxes would go away, and they would be totally secure from the threat of the Russian and Chinese ships that are constantly surrounding them. Together, what a great nation it would be," Trump wrote on Truth Social. The U.S. Congress has certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2024 presidential election on Monday. Vice President Kamala Harris oversaw the process of certifying her own defeat, acknowledging Trump's 312 Electoral College votes to her 226. Monday's ceremony came 4 years to the day after a violent mob of Trump supporters smashed their way into the Capitol, demanding then-Vice President Mike Pence refuse to certify Joe Biden's win. Vice President Harris said after Monday's certification, she was simply doing her constitutional duty.
America's democracy is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. Every single person, their willingness to fight for and respect the importance of our democracy. Otherwise, it is very fragile and it will not be able to withstand moments of crisis. And today, America's democracy stood.
Lawyers for President-elect Trump have asked a federal court to block the public release of the report by special counsel Jack Smith into the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case and Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election. Trump's lawyers filed the request with U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed judge in Florida who previously ruled Smith's appointment was unconstitutional. Here in New York, Judge Juan Merchan has denied Trump's request to postpone his sentencing Friday. Trump was convicted on 34 felony charges of attempting to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Meanwhile, a federal judge declared former New York City mayor and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani in contempt of court for failing to facilitate the handover of $11 million in personal assets he owes to election workers Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. It's part of the $148 million defamation judgment the pair won after Giuliani falsely accused them of committing election fraud in Georgia in 2020. President Biden's issued new protections for U.S. waters, banning new drilling off the Atlantic coast, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, the Pacific coast off California, Oregon, and Washington, and part of the Bering Sea. While environmental groups hailed the move, President-elect Trump responded by vowing to reverse the ban immediately upon taking office and fulfilling his campaign promise to, quote, drill, baby, drill, unquote. It's not clear if Trump can do so without going through Congress. The U.S. has transferred 11 Yemeni prisoners from Guantanamo Bay to Oman, nearly halving the number of Guantanamo's remaining prisoners. None of the released men were ever charged or given due process during their more than 20-year-long imprisonment. Rights groups are calling on the Biden administration to resettle Guantanamo's last 15 prisoners and close the prison once and for all. Six of those remaining have never been charged with a crime. Three have been cleared for transfer by the Biden administration. The Pentagon's reached a historic settlement with some 35,000 LGBTQ veterans who were dismissed under the discriminatory Don't Ask, Don't Tell or similar policies, which forced military members to remain in the closet. Under the settlement, the discharge records of those affected will be restored from less than honorable to honorable, granting them access to veteran services and benefits they'd previously been denied. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed in 2011. The city of Minneapolis has agreed to a federal consent decree mandating reforms to its police department. Under the agreement, Minneapolis must monitor and investigate allegations of police misconduct, limit the use of force, improve officer training, and respect protesters' First Amendment rights. Officials race to finalize the agreement before Donald Trump's inauguration, as the former Trump administration opposed the use of consent decrees to reform police departments. The agreement comes more than 4.5 years after George Floyd was murdered by former police officer Derek Chauvin, sparking a global movement for police accountability, prison abolition, and racial justice. This comes just days after the Justice Department submitted its proposed consent decree over inhumane and brutal conditions faced by prisoners at the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, Georgia. Dozens of prisoners have died there in recent years, including LaShawn Thompson, a black man who is being held in the jail's psychiatric wing, where his family says he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs in his cell. Chinese media are reporting at least 95 people were killed and 130 others injured when a large earthquake struck Tibet earlier today. Early reports from the region suggested hundreds of houses collapsed from the magnitude 7.1 earthquake. Austria could be ruled by a far-right government for the first time since World War II after the leader of the extreme-right Freedom Party, Herbert Kickl, was tasked with forming a new ruling coalition. This comes after Austria's main centrist parties failed to establish their own coalition government. The Freedom Party won Austria's parliamentary elections in September on a nationalist anti-immigrant platform, sending shockwaves throughout Europe. It was founded in the wake of World War II by former Nazis. Hundreds of protesters gathered in Vienna Monday.
Persecution of marginalized groups, mass deportations, cuts to social benefits, a return of a fascist state. We say that we have learned something from our history, but then at the same time, we elect a chancellor like Kicker and leave him in power. We have learned nothing from the past.
And the far-right ultra-nationalist French leader Jean-Marie Le Pen has died at the age of 96. Le Pen led France's National Front for decades, unsuccessfully running for president 5 times. He became the face of France's anti-immigrant extreme right and was repeatedly fined and convicted for hate speech and contesting crimes against humanity. His daughter, Marine Le Pen, is now head of the National Rally, formerly the National Front. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congress has certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2024 presidential election. On Monday, Vice President Kamala Harris oversaw the process of certifying her own defeat.
Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala D. Harris... Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 226 votes. This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected, President and Vice President of the United States, each for a term beginning on the 20th day of January, 2025.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson grinned as he sat behind Kamala Harris. The certification took place on January 6, formerly a day of unremarkable procedure, and 4 years to the day after a violent mob of Trump supporters smashed their way into the Capitol, demanding then-Vice President Mike Pence refuse to certify Joe Biden's win. This comes as people who went to jail for their role in January 6 are asking President-elect Trump for a full and complete presidential pardon, including far-right Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio, who was convicted of seditious conspiracy. For more, we're joined by Joshua Kaplan, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica, who covered the January 6, 2020 riot at the U.S. Capitol, has published a major new expose headlined The Militia and the Mole. His related piece in August is headlined Armed and Underground, Inside the Turbulent Secret World of an American Militia. His new piece is based on material provided by a wilderness survival trainer named John Williams, who was upset by January 6th and decided to go undercover in this same militia movement. He gathered 2 years of material, brought it to Kaplan to report on it. On Monday, Williams released another giant trove of materials on a website called Distributed Denial of Secrets. For more, we're joined by Josh Kaplan in our New York studio. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Talk about the significance of yesterday, where you were as you covered January 6th, and then who exactly John Williams is and the significance of his revelation to you, Josh.
Absolutely. So, I mean, after January 6th, which I think it's easy to forget at this point, was an incredibly violent day. I've you know, stood in the on the porches of Capitol Police members who adore Trump, but were just shaken by the beatings they saw that day, the attacks they saw on their colleagues. And after January 6th, history would have suggested, and a lot of militia leaders even thought, that the movement may not survive, that the backlash would be so intense that the militias would go extinct for an extended period of time. And they started to resurge in the years since and expand at a dramatic pace because, in large part, this is in some because of the policies of social media companies, but it's also because Trump and other prominent Republicans have embraced the January 6th rioters as patriots and political prisoners. And that's given the kind of license for these for people to join these groups again and to expand rapidly. And one thing that's changed since January 6th is that militias have become much more careful at keeping their activities underground. And these files that Williams provided give this incredibly candid, detailed window inside this underground. And they reveal how these groups have united convicted criminals with doctors, government attorneys, active duty police officers, and U.S. soldiers.
And we know there were a number of active duty police officers and veterans and soldiers at January 6th in the insurrection.
Absolutely. No, it was they were disproportionately represented in that and in militias.
And at the same time, you have 140 Capitol and Metropolitan Police who were injured in this attack.
Absolutely. Yes. And then also one thing that came out in these files is the dangerous vigilante operations these militias have still been doing that they had managed to keep a secret. And that ranges from armed patrols at the border rounding up migrants to trying to crack down on voters casting absentee ballots, surveillance of local journalists and activists, assaulting Black Lives Matter protesters, and then lastly, in these files, there's this constant drumbeat of incredibly heated debate over whether they should escalate things even further and commit acts of mass political violence.
So, you write, the documents laid out a remarkable odyssey. Posing as an ideological compatriot, John Williams had penetrated the top ranks of two of the most prominent right-wing militias in the country. So tell us who John Williams is. Talk about how you came in contact with him, why he gave you so much information over the years, and now has himself released a trove of information just yesterday. And who the groups are he was working with, from AP3 to a number of these groups.
Absolutely. So John Williams, he's a loner. He's extremely intelligent, well-read, introspective. He's also extraordinarily intense about almost every aspect of his life. And he had a
tumultuous upbringing in young adulthood. He was convicted of a series of crimes that led to him spending 3 years in prison.
He lived where?
He lived in Utah. That's where he infiltrated these groups. And after he got out of prison, became a wilderness survival instructor. And that is how he says he first came in contact with these groups. They had hired him for a training. He tried to move on. And after January 6th, he was outraged and ashamed that he'd helped them in some small way. And he thought that, as he tells it, that the countless people would respond to this attack with aggressive action. And so he decided to reach back out and try to do a undercover operation of his own devising, as kind of a freelance vigilante.
As a freelance vigilante and kind of journalist.
Yes, yes. No, absolutely. And he didn't have a plan at first, but he is, I mean, another thing to know about John is that he's a extraordinarily talented liar. And that's, I mean, that was the key to why he was so effective here. But, you know, I was able to authenticate these files he had
now,
very
carefully.
Now, he reached
out to a number of journalists, but you responded.
Yes, yes. And so my relationship started with him towards the end of his journey in these groups. And I received this mysterious anonymous email that he'd sent to an array of reporters. And he didn't, in this email, say, I'm an infiltrator who's gotten inside these groups. It was much more vague, but there was something intriguing about it. I responded, and you know, to be honest, I wasn't expecting much at first. I was skeptical, but we spoke a handful of times over encrypted calls, and then he sent me these files.
So talk about AP3. Talk about the Proud Boys. Talk about his rise in the militia movement in Utah, even as he is exposing it.
Yeah, so so AP3, it's American Patriots 3%. This is I think people might be familiar with the 3%ers, and really, you know, the largest or 3%er group in the country for a long time has been AP3. And it's one of the largest militias in the U.S.
And explain why it's 3%. What does that stand for?
That's this based on the claim that only 3% of Americans fought in the American Revolution. And so it's this idea that a very small group of dedicated people can stand up to tyranny, which is what they see in kind of liberal governance. And he was able to, you know, John was so successful at this that he ultimately got the head of the group's, of AP3's Utah chapter, fired, and then convinced people to put John in his place. So he was leading that group. He was sleeping in the home of the new leader of the Oath Keepers after the previous leader, the founder, went to prison for was sentenced for seditious conspiracy for conspiring to violently overthrow the government on January 6th. And he was going through this guy's files the other night. I mean, it's amazing. I listened to these tapes and I spent an enormous amount of time authenticating them. And he sounded like a completely different person on the call, just a brand new personality from the John I was speaking to on the phone. And these militia guys loved him, and it enabled him to lie and manipulate his way into the heart of several of these groups.
So talk about how the groups interact. And also, he was almost exposed when he actually reached out to warn a journalist that they were a target.
Yes, yeah, so there's a lot of interplay among these groups. I mean, I think a lot of lay people think of them like gangs, like you're a Proud Boy, so you're forever a Proud Boy. They're much more porous than that. People kind of cycle, but members will cycle between them. One group, and the missions of each are kind of ill-defined. It's part of why they've been able to grow so much. They're shared grievances, but when it comes to questions of, are we trying to overthrow the government, or are we trying to just police the border in our own dangerous vigilante operations, or are we trying to get involved in local politics? Those aren't questions that have predefined answers, and so there's constant debate about them, and it enables them to, in some ways, you know, especially at the local level, bridge more mainstream conservative politics and more violent action. But the through line in all of these is paramilitary training, intense firearms training, where they will do things like practice storming buildings with semi-automatic rifles or doing an ambush with explosives.
What did he learn about the Salt Lake Tribune reporter?
Yeah, so the reporter, so he was on a call at one point, and there was a conversation about, some woman started speaking about how there was a journalist in her small town who was covering the town's vice mayor, who was under fire for a homophobic remark. And she thought this journalist was leading a secret far-left plot, and also was her neighbor, and she thought he'd been trying to harass her by leaving dead animals in her lawn. And so she seemed in the grip of something. And then at the end of this call, she said, I think I need to settle a score with this guy.
They're still neighbors.
They're still neighbors. It's getting to the deep state local level. It's got to be stopped. And this scared John. He felt obligated to warn this journalist. And so he sent him an anonymous email. The next morning, he saw an article posted online. The journalist had written 500 words about this experience and the strange email he'd gotten, and had a screenshot of the note. And there'd been some lines pointing, there's a lot of evidence pointing that John was the guy who leaked this. And so he thought, I'm finally found out. People are going to know I'm the mole. I'm going to go on the run. And so he picks up his life and flees to the desert, so he can disappear for at least several weeks.
So right now, we've just passed January 6th. President-elect Trump has called it a day of love. Enrique Tarrio, on January 6th, who was convicted and imprisoned for seditious conspiracy, head of the Proud Boys, has asked for a pardon. He actually wasn't there on January 6th. He was, picked up before January 6th? But explain the significance of that and where the Proud Boys fit into this story. And then the larger question, the visuals outside the jail where January 6th insurrectionists are held. There is a demand for a sort of global pardon of the protesters. President Trump, when asked by journalists whether he's going to pardon them, he said, not in the first 90 days, 30 days, like on the first day, in the first minutes. Not clear if it's going to be a blanket pardon, or if he's at other times said it's going to be, he's going to look at each and every case.
Yeah. I mean, so the Proud Boys, to answer your first question, they're another militia group that is very much kind of sees itself as an arm of Trump, as a kind of the Trump street fighters, essentially. And their trademark until January 6th was fighting with activists in the street and kind of attacking people at left-wing protests. And they, according to the Department of Justice, were really, as much as any group, what led the charge that enabled the Capitol riot to happen, enabled the Capitol to be stormed. And so these pardons, the ramifications could be massive. They have the potential to trigger a renaissance for militant extremists, because there's no precedent for this kind of message of protection and support coming from the White House. And so if these pardons are as sweeping as Trump has repeatedly suggested they might be, if they include those who assaulted police officers that day, how that will be interpreted is that you can commit even serious crimes and not be punished for that, as long as you're doing it for the quote-unquote right cause.
And finally, going back to that affiliation with law enforcement, John Williams talking about how others in AP3 and other groups kept telling him, you can contact your local sheriff.
Yeah, I mean, these groups view that as critical to their success, having allies in law enforcement. The signature of these groups is putting themselves in incredibly volatile situations with a lot of guns. And so they want to have police, if not
actively help them, at least leave them alone, see them as a friend.
They have a spreadsheet of the sheriffs that are friendly to them.
They have a, yes, they have a spreadsheet. Every member in AP3 got a spreadsheet of the sheriffs in their state, was told to reach out to them, mark who's friendly, who's not. And they have these, you know, very detailed and kind of business school-esque tactics for buttering up police officers, buttering up sheriffs, trying to kind of pitch themselves. It's an incredibly organized effort that we don't, and in some cases has been quite successful, it seems. And we don't really normally get a view of that playbook, of those tactics, and how the sheer amount of work that they put into this.
And finally, as we look at what happened in Las Vegas with the Green Beret active duty who shot himself and his Tesla, you could call it a tank, exploded in front of the Trump Hotel, as well as the Army veteran in New Orleans. These what look like lone wolf military guys, heavily armed. Did you see, as you were exploring this terrain with John Williams, people like that?
Yes. I mean, this is certainly, and it's not... you know, I don't want to get into specific incidents that we haven't reported, but I mean, there have been high profile, nothing like the Las Vegas attack, but high profile incidents in the 2022 midterms, for instance, of a man doing an armed stakeout of a ballot box and getting in a confrontation with a woman sparked a national news cycle. He was an AP3 leader. Doing an AP3 operation, and there he was not linked back to the group or to any kind of organized effort until John came along. And so certainly these people right now may well be lone wolves. I have no reason to suggest otherwise. And there's, you know, people can be radicalized online right now. But there's also this long history of, and it's, I think, become an even more concerted effort potentially in recent years, of people committing acts of violence who look like lone wolves, take care to look like lone wolves, and then it comes out very long after the fact that they actually were working with or had a very long history with organized militia groups.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us and for doing this deep investigation. Joshua Kaplan, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica, who covered the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, has a major new exposé. We'll link to it. It's headlined "The Militia and the Mole." When we come back, we speak with the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha, his latest piece in The New Yorker, Requiem for a Refugee Camp. Stay with us.
The state, the church, the plan, the way, the dead, the mind, the cut, what's the verb behind it all? The do, the how, the why, the where.
According to Nouns by Minutemen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Gaza, where Israeli forces are continuing their unrelenting attacks, killing scores of Palestinians, even as Israeli and Hamas officials resume talks in Qatar aimed at a ceasefire. Al Jazeera reports Israel carried out over 100 bombings over the weekend. According to Gaza's health ministry, 31 Palestinians were killed in the last 24 hours. The UN is warning its efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip at a breaking point after Israeli forces opened fire on a World Food Program convoy over the weekend. Staffers documented at least 16 bullet holes in their aid convoy's three vehicles, saying the shooting left them terrified. More than 330 aid workers in Gaza have been killed since October 7, 2023, according to the United Nations. Overnight on Monday, Dr. Tabat Salim, a Palestinian neonatal doctor and volunteer at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Nusayrat refugee camp. More than 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed in Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Dr. Salim's killing follows the destruction of the Kamel Adwan Hospital, the last remaining hospital in northern Gaza, over the weekend. The head of the World Health Organization's once again urged Israel to release Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, director of Kamel Adwan, from prison after he was arrested by Israeli forces along with other medical workers during a raid on December 27th. But Israel is not confirming that they have Dr. Safia. For more on the deteriorating situation in Gaza, we're joined in Syracuse, New York, by the acclaimed Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha. His recent piece for The New Yorker magazine is headlined Requiem for a Refugee Camp, which focuses on Gaza's largest refugee camp, now in ruins, Jabalia. It's where his grandparents grew up. Masab Abu Toha, joining us from Syracuse. Thank you so much for joining us again, Masab. If you can talk about Jabalia and all of this latest news we're getting out of Gaza. You know, we spoke to you in Gaza when you were there with your family. We spoke to you after Rafat Al-Arir, your colleague, fellow poet, was killed in an Israeli airstrike, professor at Islamic University. We spoke to you in Cairo when you just gotten out with your family. We spoke to you in New York here in the studio when your book came out, Forest of Noise. And now we're talking to you today, this utterly painful piece, Requiem for a Refugee Camp, that you've just published in The New Yorker. Talk about your experience and what the centrality of this camp.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy, for the coverage. I mean, the painful thing is that we are talking about things today and next year would happen that we are talking about the same thing, the same losses, or even worse. So today is the anniversary of my friend's Ma'ruf Al-Ashqar's killing. He was killed last year, and just 2 months ago, his father was killed in an airstrike. So today is his first anniversary. And we and the city Beit Lahia, which is next to Jabalia, the Jabalia refugee camp, is under the Israeli occupation. I mean, now when we talk about the Israeli occupation, we are no longer talking about settlements in the West Bank or, you know, or Palestinian cities occupied by Israel in 1948. But now we can talk about the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, because not only did they expel people. And this is what I'm talking about in my piece about the refugee camp. Not only did they expel people, most people in the Jabalia refugee camp have been expelled by the Israeli occupation. They not only expelled these people, but they also blew up the houses in the refugee camp where people used to live for 70 or more years. I mean, the house where my maternal grandparents were born, where they grew up, where they had my mother and her siblings. This house does not exist anymore. And this is really a very devastating thing for refugees. The refugee camp is a place that should have been a temporary place for people. They should be living in the refugee camp until they could return to the houses of their grandparents or their parents or even their own houses in Yaffa, in Haifa, etc. But these people were expelled from the refugee camp. The refugee camp is destroyed, and these people are now living in other newly constructed refugee camps. And when we talk about refugee camps right now in Gaza, these are group of tents that do not protect people from the heat, do not protect people from from the Israeli airstrikes. And we watched so many airstrikes that Israel carried out that were targeting tents, especially in the humanitarian zone. So the Jebel refugee camp is the largest of the 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. It was a home for about 120,000 people, all of them refugees from cities and villages close to the Gaza Strip. So it is a very devastating loss for people, not only to lose their friends, to lose their families, to lose their house, but also not to know whether they would be able to return to the refugee camp, which was supposed to be a temporary place. Just imagine, Amy, that you are expelled from your house in Yaffa in 1948, and then you live in a refugee camp, and then this same occupation comes and destroys the refugee camp. Now you are farther and farther from your dream of returning. Now you are dreaming of returning to the refugee camp. So this is really the tragedy of the Palestinian people right now.
This latest news that we have, we don't know where Dr. Abu Safia is. Many people know his name, head of Kamal Adwan Hospital, because he has been reporting on the conditions of the hospital. And now Israel is saying they don't have him. People are saying they saw him taken away. How is it that his lawyers cannot see him? You have the World Food Program, the UN organization, their convoy fired upon. Number of health medical personnel, from doctors to nurses to hospital staff, who've been killed in Gaza. Talk about the significance of this and what these hospitals meant for you when you lived in Gaza with your children and your wife.
So, Amy, really, really, something that really devastates my heart is that we are watching these things happening as we are talking. I mean, we have the news that Dr. Hotam Abu Safia was abducted from inside the hospital. We saw the hospital where he was working burned and turned into ashes. And we saw the news about the Hind Rajab family and Hind Rajab herself. And we saw doctors and journalists being targeted and killed. So we have all this news, and nothing is changing the world in terms of taking action against Israel, punishing it. Not only, I mean, they did not get the Palestinians their rights, you know, that are guaranteed by international law after 1948, but they are now watching a genocide being perpetrated by the same occupation, which was admitted to the United Nations just 1 year after it was established. Just imagine that it took Israel 1 year to become a member, a full member of the United Nations. And now it's been taking the whole world about 15 months, and we don't know for how many more. It's been taking them a long time even to stop Israel from perpetrating this well-documented genocide. And I would like, Amy, to draw your attention that one day after the Israeli army or the Israeli forces denied their position of Dr. Hassan Safia, one day later, the Israeli military spokesperson issued a statement that Dr. Hassan Abu Safia is with the Israeli army, and he is interrogated because he is suspected of being a Hamas member. So this was one thing that was issued one day after they denied their having Dr. Hassan Abu Safia. So, I mean, this tells you that Israel, whenever they are under pressure, they will succumb. They will change their minds. They will say, oh, yeah, we have him, and he is under interrogation. He's a suspected Hamas general. He's a Hamas general. He's not even Hamas. He's not only Hamas. He's a Hamas general. He's a very, very big guy in Hamas. You know, a doctor who's working with the patients, who refused to leave them, who was injured, whose son was killed. He could leave. He could leave Gaza any day because he has a Kazakhstani citizenship. And I would like to draw your attention to another thing, which is that the director of Al Auda Hospital, Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, has been abducted by the Israeli forces from inside the Al Auda Hospital for 350 days. And there is no information about this doctor. I mean, the world started to pay attention and to advocate on behalf of Dr. Hassan Safia because, you know, he had some reports, he had an Instagram page, he has been talking about the situation, so people knew him. So that's why people want him to be out. You know, because they feel like they knew him in person. But this Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, this is the case of about hundreds of other people. These people, no one knows about them. You know, we haven't seen, I mean, I've never seen Dr. Ahmed Mhanna. I've never seen a video of him. But He's a doctor. He's the director of the Al-Auda Hospital, and he's been abducted for about 350 days, about a year. And there is no news about him, and no one talks about him. And this is the case of so many people that we don't know about until they are dead, just like Dr. Adnan Al-Burj. He was abducted from the same hospital, Al-Auda Hospital. And the people paid attention to him when he died, and people, oh, yeah, yes. I mean, we don't want to die. We don't want to suffer for people or for governments to sympathize with us and say, oh, yes, we need him, bring him back. He is innocent. No, everyone in Gaza is innocent. Everyone in Gaza has been living this hell by Israel for decades, not for 15 months.
Mousab Abu Toha, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Palestinian poet and author. Will link to your piece in The New Yorker, Requiem for a Refugee Camp. He's the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. His latest book is called Forest of Noise. Up next, we look at President Carter's legacy in Latin America with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. But first, we'll play a clip of President Carter, when I interviewed him at the Carter Center in Atlanta.
Never went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind, and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sewing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, because I think I'm better than you. The boy said, my name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet and you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul. Opened up his case and he said, I'll start this show and fire.
The Charlie Daniels Band. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The remains of President Jimmy Carter arrive in Washington, D.C. today, where he'll be honored by a ceremony at the U.S. Capitol before lying in state through Thursday morning. The casket carrying the 39th American president will leave the Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta, where thousands of mourners paid their respects over the weekend, and travel to Dobbins Air Reserve Base north of Atlanta before arriving at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland with a motorcade into Washington, D.C. His casket will be carried to the Capitol Rotunda for an afternoon service with members of Congress, after which the public can pay respects. President Carter's state funeral will take place at the National Cathedral in Washington Thursday, which President Biden has declared a national day of mourning. President Carter died December 29th at the age of 100. We interviewed him a number of times on Democracy Now! This is a short clip of an interview I did with him when I went down to Atlanta to the Carter Center in 2007. These views are much less often being referred to as President Carter is being talked about and eulogized. We were talking about his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Americans don't want to know. And many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land.
That's the late president on Palestine. For the full interview and our other interviews with President Carter, you can go to democracynow.org. Today, we look at President Jimmy Carter's legacy in Latin America with Greg Grandin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, professor of history at Yale University. His forthcoming book, America, America, A New History of the New World, which will be out in April. If you can first, before we get into Panama, because it was under President Carter that Panama Canal was returned to Panama, the oversight of it, and before we talk about Salvador and Nicaragua, overall, President Carter's legacy in Latin America?
Well, I think it was mixed, and it was confused. I mean, Carter was, in many ways, a transitional president that came to power having to deal with the combined disasters of both Vietnam and Watergate, and rebuild trust and rebuild the kind of moral foundation on which the United States justified its exercise of power. And in many ways, Latin America was the place to do that. I mean, just to set the stage a little bit, set the scene, Carter comes to power and he's inaugurated in 1977. Pretty much all of South America is run by anti-communist dictatorships that were installed or supported by the United States. The Nixon Doctrine, coups under Lyndon B. Johnson, coups under Kennedy. They brought to power one anti-communist dictatorship after another, largely in response to the Cuban Revolution, backing up even further. In Central America, they weren't dictatorships, but they were insurgencies, revolutionary insurgencies, and anti-communist states fighting those insurgencies. And domestically, you had a very anti-imperialist Congress elected after Watergate and after Vietnam that insisted that the United States start pulling back some of its support for dictatorships, for more of its unsavory allies. And Latin America seemed the place to do it. And they did. They cut aid to Uruguay. They cut aid to They limited aid to Chile. They cut aid to Brazil, all the military to Argentina. And of course, that became a kind of shining example of what the United States should be in terms of its foreign policy. The reality was actually more complicated. It was also the place where the United States started putting conditionalities on military aid. And obviously we see that under Gaza, how that's played out. But that the United States would, you know, there would be certain markers or certain check marks that countries had to meet in terms of human rights monitoring before military aid was released. In many ways, it was more symbolic than real. In a country like Guatemala, for instance, where the United States did cut off military aid, it didn't cut off military aid that was already in the pipeline, so that continued to flow. Now, in Central America, where you had insurgencies, these were kind of like a stress test for this new foreign policy, this new moralism that Jimmy Carter represented. And he didn't at first cut aid off to Nicaragua, and he didn't cut off aid to El Salvador.
Meaning in Nicaragua to Somoza.
To Somoza or to the junta in El Salvador.
Now, let's talk about El Salvador, yeah. Because you have Archbishop Oscar Romero, who has been canonized a saint by the Vatican, who was assassinated on March 24th, 1980. He appealed to President Carter weeks before his assassination to stop the flow of aid.
Directly, in a very impassioned letter I teach that letter, and Carter didn't respond. He left it to Cyrus Vance to respond. He didn't respond, and they didn't cut off aid. And even prior to that, Cyrus Vance was Carter's Secretary of State. Brzezinski was his National Security Advisor, and in many ways you can think of them as two sides. Like, Vance was considered more dovish and Brzezinski more hawkish, a little bit more complicated than that. But Brzezinski was complaining to the Vatican about Oscar Romero, that he had been moved too far to the left. This was before the letter. So you see that, it's not just Jimmy Carter, it's the administration he presides over. It's much more.
When Oscar Romero was giving his homily that was broadcast throughout El Salvador, when he was gunned down, He was appealing to the soldiers of El Salvador, to the paramilitaries. He said, I beseech you, I urge you, I plead yeah. with you to put down your arms.
Yeah. Actually, that was a day before he was assassinated. He was assassinated in a smaller church. It was a smaller mass in a smaller parish in San Salvador. He was shot through the heart. By a death squad that was trained by the United States and led by Roberto de Albizon.
He would later become
the head of the Arena Party. I don't believe he was president, but no. He became the head of the party that ruled El Salvador, the Arena Party. But he became a very influential politician, Roberto de Albizon.
Right, he was a member of the Legislative Assembly.
Yeah, and he was a favorite of the far right. So Jimmy Carter, in many ways, is a foil for the rising right in the United States, and his policies in Latin America kind of captured the contradictions and I would use the word contradiction rather than confusion of Carter's foreign policy. You know, he came to power. He came to power promising to end the United States' inordinate fear of communism. He gave a speech in Notre Dame that was considered a kind of a new kind of doctrine, that the United States was moving away from both the ideological excess and the support for dictatorships that led to wars like Vietnam or coups in Chile. But events got ahead of him in many ways. In Central America, the rise of the Sandinistas and insurgencies led to contradictory policies in El Salvador. He, for instance, continued supporting the military regime and its dead squads. In Nicaragua, he cut off economic aid, but he continued military aid as he tried to kind of guide, force Somoza out and lead to more democratic elections. But the Sandinistas had the momentum. There was the Iranian Revolution in the Persian Gulf, which led to the Carter Doctrine, which was written by Brzezinski and basically asserted that the United States would respond with military force to anything that they perceived as a threat to U.S. interests.
I want to play a clip of President Carter's commencement speech at the University of Notre Dame in 1977.
Democracy's great recent success in India, Portugal, Spain, Greece, show that our confidence in this system is not misplaced. Being confident of our own future, we are now free of that inordinate fear of communism, which once led us to embrace any dictator who joined us in that fear.
So that was President Carter, the significance of what he was saying there when it relates to, for example, Latin America.
Well, that he was saying that he was going to deal with third world nationalism on its own terms, not as just a front for geopolitical Cold War politics, meaning the Soviet Union. But that gives way very quickly. I mean, we only have a few minutes, but we have to say that it was under Carter that the CIA began its operation in Afghanistan, began supporting the Mujahideen. It was the Carter administration in July 1979, urged by Brzezinski to begin providing non-lethal aid to what becomes the Mujahideen. All of these things led to what the end of detente and the pulling of the Soviet Union deeper into Afghanistan and the weaponization of Islam as a geopolitical tool in the United States that we're still living with the consequences today. And for all of his decency and humanity, especially compared to the orgastic wealth and the clown circus that we're living under now, we have to kind of look at how Carter, some of the more unfortunate legacies of Carter's administration.
Now, President Carter did sign an agreement in 1977 to gradually return control of the Panama Canal to Panama. This came after mass protests in Panama wanting the return of their canal. Talk about the significance of this deal, and now we go full circle as President Trump threatens to take it back, and the flags will fly at half staff during the inauguration, something President Trump has decried, saying it's the first time, because Biden has called for flags to fly at half staff for the 30 days after Carter's death.
Yes, the return of Panama was a huge symbolic and material correction of an injustice. Panama was a province of Colombia. The United States, Teddy Roosevelt, teamed up with J.P. Morgan to basically, coax a revolution there, an insurgency, and declared, recognized the independence of Panama, and then built a canal, and that the United States controlled the Panama Canal Zone, and Carter's return of it. It was very symbolic.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor of history at Yale University, Greg Grandin. And finally today, our deepest condolences to Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez on the passing of his mother, Florinda Guillen. She was 97 years old. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dean Augusta, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Anjali Kamat, Tarina Nadouras, and Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat. Banter. Beat.
Banter. When I say beat, you say banter. Beat. Banter.